The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
You're listening to theflypod.com, and I'm your host, Gary Puckett. All of our programs are offered free and clear and come to you exclusively through our New Media program feeds. If you have a portable MP3 player or an iPod, go on our website and subscribe to the program categories of your choice. We are your source for local world time-shifted MP3 audio programming and are totally immersed in the task of unzipping the exciting world of new media podcasting. On my show today, I have a very special guest, but before that, before I introduce him, I want to lay this little tune on you. Tell me what you think of this. You can email us at shout@theflypod.com. This little tune's called "That's Why I'm Asking." We'll be right back.
We've steady dated, and I think you're really fine. With me, you've really rated. Won't you be mine? That's why I'm asking this one thing of you. Oh, please be my steady, be mine, and be true. You know that I love you, you know how I feel, and if you were mine, would make my dream. That's why I'm asking this one thing of you. Oh, please be my steady, be mine, and be true. Words cannot tell you the way that I care, wanting to hold you, always be there. That's why I'm asking this one thing of you. Oh, please my steady, be mine, and be true. 2 months we've steady dated, and I think you're really fine. With me you've really rated, won't you be mine? That's why I'm asking this one thing of you. Oh, please be my steady, be mine, and be true. 2 months we've steady dated, and I think you're really fine. With me you've really rated, won't you be mine?
My guest on today's show is singer, songwriter, and entertainer Carl Dobkins Jr., perhaps best known for one of his biggest hits, My Heart is an Open Book, which I believe hit number 3 on the Billboard chart back in 1959, and his career extended on into the 60s, and we're going to have a nice conversation today with him. His career in the music industry started at a pretty young age, too. Carl, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Gary. Nice being here.
It's a pleasure to have you join me today.
Thank you.
So at what age did you actually begin playing and singing?
Well, when I was 9 years old, I got a ukulele, and it had an Arthur Guthrie attachment, a little plastic attachment that went on the neck, and you would push these buttons and it would play the chords. Well, my mom played guitar, my dad played guitar, aunts and uncles played guitar. It was, as you said earlier, a social thing. And I took the attachment off, and I said, well, gee, that's where the fingers go. So I put the fingers, learned how to play the 4 strings, and then my mom taught me how to apply that to the guitar. But my hand wasn't big enough time, so I just drowned it out the last two. I didn't play the last 2 strings. So I was 9 years old. And then I started singing in high school, doing weekend dances and things like that.
So you come from a pretty musical family then.
Yes, a lot of people play the guitar.
Yeah.
Nobody professionally or anything, but a lot of fun. Everybody just, I still remember some of the old, they used to call them hillbilly songs, not country like it is now.
For sure. Well, Carl, when you started out, you had recorded a couple songs at Fraternity Records and very quickly found yourself under a contract with Decca Records, I believe, and you went off to Nashville and recorded a song called My Heart is an Open Book at Owen Bradley Studio in Nashville. Tell me about that experience, because you were, what, all of 18 years of age at the time?
I was actually, I think I was 17, my first record with That's Why I'm Asking and Take Hold of My Hand that was on Fraternity, Harry okay. Carlson's label. Shadow Shea, later on, after Harry passed away, bought the rights to it. Shadow Shea was my neighbor here, and he's kind of a Cincinnati icon, and rides around in the Harvest Day Parade with his dog and his convertible with the top down. But I recorded that and actually was shoved in on the leftover time of Kathy Carr, who had Ivory Tower hit, was shoved in as a favor, I think, by Harry to my manager, Gil and Kay Shepherd, on her time to record this song. And oh, I was thrilled. But it really didn't do anything. And so then we went to a studio somewhere in Blue Ash and did If You Don't Want My Lovin' and Love Is Everything. I'm sorry, we did that at King Studio is where we did it. And so my manager sold the master to Decca, and then there was a little bit of reaction in Charleston, West Virginia. That was number one for 6 weeks in a row. No one ever heard of it anywhere else. If You Don't Want My Love, number one, 6 weeks in a row. And then that then got into the My Heart's an Open Book.
So it wasn't actually a hit instantly. I mean, during those years, it's my understanding that if a radio station didn't have a copy or just flat out wouldn't play it, it received very little exposure. Right. Is that correct?
Right. There was, I know the song is listed in the Top 1000. Joel Wilburn, who wrote a book called The Top 1000 from 55 to 85, he said that during this period of time, there was over 100,000 single releases. So your shot at getting in that Top 1000 for those years
was pretty
slim, right. But it was out. We recorded it. Of course, Decca wasn't real well known for rock and roll at that point, or younger artists. They had Brenda Lee. And so most of those copies, those disc jockey copies, wound up in the garbage can. And then 6 months later, when it started to hit, they had to go and remail the disc jockey copies out to them.
Oh, my gosh.
I really wasn't thrilled with the song. I wanted to do like a rock and roll song, man. But
well, let's take a quick break, and I want to play for our listeners My Heart is an Open Book off of your CD. I'm sure that our listeners will remember this as a top-of-the-charts tune, and then we'll be right back. So here is My Heart is an Open Book.
Don't believe all those lies, darling, just believe your eyes and look, look. My heart is an open book, I love nobody but you. Look, look, my heart is an open book, my love is honest and true. Some jealous so-and-so wants us to part. That's why he's telling you that I've got a cheating heart. But don't believe all those lies, darling, just believe your eyes and look, look. My heart is an open book, I love nobody but you. Some jealous so-and-so wants us to part. That's why he's telling you that I've got a cheating heart. But don't believe all those lies, darling, just believe your eyes and look, look. My heart is an open book, I love nobody but you, nobody but you, nobody but you.
Okay, that was My Heart is an Open Book with Carl Dobkins Jr. Carl, how is it that you connected up with Hal David and Lee Pockris.
Well, they were the writers of My Heart's an Open Book. I never met Hal David personally. I met Lee Pockris after My Heart's an Open Book had been a hit, and I met him. There was a building in New York City. I forget the name of the street, but it's very famous. All of the hits were coming out of there, publishers and record producers. And these songwriters would go from floor to floor plugging their songs, and Lee Pockris came in to plug a song that he had written, and that's how I met him. But then, of course, naturally, later, Hal David became with Burt Bacharach and a lot of great hits.
It was like a musical merchant songwriter's flea market or something.
Yeah, that's the way it was, right? And we were talking earlier that when you didn't have a hit record or never had a hit record, you'd have to go from on 16th Avenue South in Nashville into the publisher, and they would just kind of play you the leftovers. They had dub recordings, and you'd get the leftovers. But as soon as you got a hit, then people were knocking at your motel door and coming to the studio to trying to get you to sing the song. Felice and Budlow Bryant would actually sing their songs live with a guitar to plug their songs. You know, these are our songs. We're going to sing them the way we want, and this is what we think you'll like.
That is funny.
They sing it to you.
Well, what was your impression, being 17, 18, 19 years old, long in through there, that point in your life, what was your impression of the music business? What was it like in the late 50s and in through the 60s?
Well, we were, most of us young, teenagers. If you were over 20 or so, you were starting to get kind of old, you know. But there weren't the drugs that we went beyond pure energy, you know, the bus trips and the road tours and that, and just really there weren't the drugs, the negative aspect of it. It was very competitive. You know, you were a hero one day and at the bottom of the heap the next day. Of course, being young, you really didn't look that far ahead to think, well, how long is this going to last? You just like take every day for the day it was.
Sure.
And but it was exciting, very exciting, and to be part of it, I'm so thankful that I was allowed to be a part of it, and the public was the ones that permitted me to do that.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, you did a lot of touring with a lot of other big names in the business as well. Tell me, who are some of the artists you traveled and appeared with over the years?
Oh, gee, I almost hesitate to mention any because I'm afraid I'll leave someone out. But the Fabian, Frankie Avalon, Frankie Ford, the Skyliners. Then I had the good fortune of being invited down in 1999 to do a 50s and 60s rock and roll graffiti show. And we videotaped for 2 days in Nashville, and there were 36 artists of the who's who from the 50s and 60s.
That just sounds like a good
Jimmy
time.
Rogers, you know, Honeycomb.
Great voice.
Carl LaGardner, the last surviving member of the Coasters, the guy from the Tequila, the Champs. I go on and on, and it was just, it was great. It was almost like a religious experience. In fact, I have in the den wall a record that was put in the middle of this large cardboard or whatever you want to call it, and everyone signed that to the other artist. So there's only 36 of these in the world, and it's from, like I said, from all the artists, the primary artists from that period of time.
That's a keeper.
Oh yeah, I think so.
That's a keeper.
I'm not gonna try to hawk that on eBay.
Well, you performed on the legendary Dick Clark Bandstand show so many times it's hard to keep track. But I have to ask you, behind the scenes, what was that whole production really like?
It was really neat. The Saturday night show was best. It was from the little theater in New York City. And you had your own dressing room, and they put the makeup on you. And there was a guy who was a Beach Nut Gum, I think was the advertiser. And this guy's job was he would just hold up in front of the camera this packet of chewing gum. That was his job.
That was it?
That was his job. But Dick Clark, what you see is what you get. Super nice guy. People would give their right arm to get on that show. And he would come up and thank each artist. Thank you for being on my show. Years later, I was in a place here, and he was playing in town, emceeing an oldie show at that point then. And I went backstage to meet him. I said, Dick, I said, you probably don't remember me. He said, Carl Dopkins Jr., My Heart's an Open Book. How have you been?
This guy wow.
And it was going to be 20 years later at least, and all of the probably literally thousands of singers that he had met and worked with.
That is something.
Just, yeah. Something else.
Tell me one of the best stories you can recall from your busy touring years.
Oh, gee. Here again, there's a lot of them. I guess the one, we went into a hoedunk place in Iowa. I think it was Twin Lakes or somewhere. It was a resort area. And there was a girl, Barbara, can't remember her last name. She was they would usually put maybe have one girl singer on the tour. Mm-hmm. So we pulled in, and the guy who was arranging this said to the manager, he said, I didn't know you had a girl on a show. We don't have enough cabins for her. He said, somebody's going to have to bunk with her. And everybody looked around and said, Carl can do it. So I assumed that that was a compliment, knowing that I was, you know, harmless and it wouldn't
bother. That you could behave.
Right, I could behave. But it was a little side bedroom off the other bedroom. But I always thought that was funny. You know, I guess some people take that as a put-down, but I consider it a compliment.
Is it a myth, or was the music industry door just wide open back then to talented individuals or groups for becoming stars overnight?
Well, it was unique opportunities. For the first time in history, young people wrote their, writing the songs, performing the songs, buying the songs. That was the important thing. So the teenage market was, and they were open to a lot of different things. And the music was more open at that point. That you could have on a top 40 list, you could have anything from a spiritual type song to a country type song. Was it easy to get in? Not really. I would imagine there's thousands and thousands who tried at the time, you know, by the grace of God and good luck. I happened to make it, but that doesn't mean that I was exceptionally any better than any of the ones that didn't make it, and
well,
maybe not as good.
We're glad you did.
Thank you.
Well, after Open Book, over the next year or so, you came out with Lucky Devil, Exclusively Yours, and If You Don't Want My Lovin'.
Yeah, that was a re-release.
Okay, that one was. Okay. Where did you do most of your recording at that time?
Most of it was done in Nashville. Later on, I did something in New York, and I did something in Hollywood that was never released. Did it for Cold Picks Records, and after I had this big session, French horns and everything, the hierarchy changed at Cold Picks Records, so that person wasn't about to release something that may be a bomb, and if he released it and it was good, he couldn't get any credit or feather in his hat anyway. So, but it's kind of ironic, when I was in the Army in Fort Dix, there was a guy next to me, Reuben was his name, and I think that was his last name, because everybody in the Army, you call them by their last name. What always bugged me, how do I get into music? I want to get into music. I said, Reuben, you know, there's so many ways, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you just keep plugging and trying. Well, that's the session in New York City that I had. There were three male singers on the group, in this group, backup group, and one of them was Reuben.
Serious?
Yeah, and when I... And I come home one day, and I'm flip on the afternoon Dick Clark show, and who's one of the same group with the hit record, Yogi Bear? Remember the Yogi Bear?
Yeah, novel? Sure.
It was Reuben. And then later on in one of the trade magazines, I saw where he was a successful producer. So that's great. He kept plugging and made it.
Even back then, and today I'm sure it's even worse, but once an artist has a big hit, it's got to be like living in a pressure cooker with a demand for a continuous flow of hits. People come, they go, and there's just a lot of pressure there. How accurate is my description of that?
It's pretty accurate, yes.
It's a tough business.
I was lucky, you know, all these oldie stations will have one-hit wonder days and that, which is, ironically accurately describes it. It's a wonder that you had one hit. It really is. It's a wonder. And I was lucky enough to have a total of four in the top 100. And that's a quadruple wonder. a lot of people didn't get that.
Yeah.
And here again, I appreciate it. It's the public that did it, not me.
Yeah. It's a great attitude and an outlook. Yeah.
Thank you.
To have. The other thing I noticed is singers who early in their careers were accustomed to singing some very high register notes with extraordinary clarity, and we could talk about numerous examples of that, only to find that the vocal cords change over the years and they're forced to bring it down an octave. What do professional singers do to protect their voices on a day-to-day basis?
I really don't know. I never paid that much attention to mine.
Do you think it's the kind of thing, if you focus too much on it, it almost paralyzes
you? Yeah, probably,
you?
Yeah. I've heard of people getting nodules on their throat from overusing it.
Overusing it.
Yeah. And I didn't have to worry about that. When we did most of these shows, they were done in like 2 20-minute segments. And you just didn't sing for... When I the first show I did in Vienna here back in 98, I think it was, I had an hour show to do.
Vienna, Austria.
Yeah. And I I thought, my goodness, an hour. I've never done an hour show before. And at my age, I was worried about not having to take the trip to the restroom instead of my voice wearing out.
So you married your high school sweetheart, Jan. Mm-hmm. You have two daughters.
Right. Carla, who just turned 45 yesterday.
Goodness sakes.
She said she's having a problem dealing with that. Not nearly the problem I'm having dealing with. And Anita's 41, I believe she is. Yeah, 41.
Yeah. And grandchildren?
Great-grandchildren. You've got five of them. Ranging from age 5 to age 21.
Carl, life's been good to you.
Sure has. God's been good to me.
So what's the latest? What's new and exciting in your life? What are you up to? Are you traveling any? I mean, what's going on?
Well, I've got did the show another show in October back in Vienna. I really don't actively pursue them. But if somebody calls, hey, I got a suitcase, throw some music in it, and
off you go.
Change of clothes, and I'm there. right now I'm in the middle of moving. We are moving to a different condo. This one's, we like it fine, but it's on an upper level, and we want to get down on a lower level so we don't go up and down the stairs all the time.
Oh, of course. Of course. It's a natural progression. Carl, I want to thank you for coming on my show
today.
Thank
you. I appreciate it.
And on behalf of our listeners and our crew of hosts here at theflypod.com, I want to thank you for your musical contributions to our lives.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm going to close the show out with a little song called Laughing Brown Eyes.
Yeah, this was originally I wrote this for my wife, and because she has beautiful brown eyes.
But there's a great trivia.
Yeah. So I wrote it for my wife, but I only had like one verse and one chorus. Well, when we went to record it, my producer said, "Gee, we need some more to this. Just one verse and one. We can't keep her." I said, "Well, I'll have to redo it." So I made it the outlaw story with the girl who takes him in and takes care of him, sort of a Marty Robbins type format.
You know, when I first listened to this track, Marty Robbins is exactly.
Oh, he was a great singer.
Oh,
great.
Yeah, yeah. Hit some great tunes. Wow. That's great. Carl, thanks again for coming.
Thank you, sir.
For more information about my guest, Carl Dopkins Jr., visit the website rockabillyhall.com, www.rockabillyhall.com. We'll have that in our hyperlink on the show notes, so you can click on it and go right there. Check out his music. That's it for my show today. I'm your host, Gary Puckett, for www.theflypod.com, your source for local world time-shifted MP3 audio podcast. Thanks for listening. Until next time, hasta luego.
Many a gambler has taken my gold. I've been tricked and cheated by lies. Now my love and my heart have both been stolen by a pair of laughing brown eyes. I rode into this town with a price upon my head. Storm clouds pouring rain from the skies. My face upon a poster, wanted live or dead. But you showed me sunshine through those laughing brown eyes. You hid me from the long arm of the law. What I was or had been, you never seemed to mind. The good things in me is all you ever saw. With laughing brown eyes, so gentle, so kind. My past is filled with darkness so dreary and black. But now that I'm safe within your arms, as long as you love me, I'll never look back and be thrilled by beautiful brown eyed charms. Many a gambler has taken my gold. I've been tricked and cheated by lies. Now my love and my heart have both been stolen by a pair of laughing brown eyes. By a pair of laughing brown eyes. By a pair of laughing brown eyes.